This is an interview with Fred A. Giaglio for the Youngstown State University World War II Veterans Project by Stephen R. Ard at 3531 Hillman, apartment 416, on the 17th of June at approximately 2:45 p.m. This is in Youngstown, Ohio. Okay, Fred, do you want to tell me when you were born and where?
Oh, I was born on August the 21st, 1906, Marseille, France.
Okay. Could you tell me a little bit about your childhood? Remember when you were a young boy?
During my childhood, I went to elementary schools in France until 1918, when I came to America. Mm-hmm. Then from then I went to grade schools in America and to high school. That was the extent of my education.
Okay. Now, what did your father do?
My father was a worker in one of the steel mills.
Mm-hmm. Did your mother work?
No, she did not.
The family going. It might be of interest to know that
when the war broke out in Europe, World War I, 1914, my father and the one brother came to America with the intention of getting enough money to book passage for the members of the family. But in the meantime, war broke out and passenger service was closed down. So we had to wait in France until war was over, which was 1918, and then we brought back into America and reunited as a family.
Do you remember what Marseille was like then?
It was I would say it was similar to a city the size of Cleveland, Ohio. A very beautiful city on the southern seacoast of France. And just like a normal American city.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest business naturally would be shipping. It had a very favorable harbor on the Mediterranean Sea.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had it was quite a large family, but the ones remaining are sister and one brother.
How many brothers and sisters did you have all together?
Well, I have to sit back a little bit. There was five brothers and four sisters. And during that time, naturally, some of the members passed away, and that's what remains of the family right now.
Mm-hmm. Right. When you came to this country, where did you come to? What city?
Well, naturally, we came to Ellis Island, the port of New York, and then came directly to Youngstown, mm-hmm. because that's where my father was employed, in one of the steel mills in Youngstown.
Mm-hmm. And then you went to grade school, to some of the schools here?
Yes.
Which schools?
First one was what is known as the Briar Hill School, located on Lafayette Street in the Briar Hill section of Youngstown. A very old school, and it went...
Okay, you were speaking about Briar Hill?
The Briar Hill School was sixth grade, only up to the sixth grade. Then we finished with that, we had to transfer over to from school, known as Jefferson School, which was farther, much further north. It was on the boundary line between Briar Hill and the northern part of the city, mm-hmm. north section of the city. And then that school went up to eighth grade. And we graduated from that. We went to Rain High School. But just about that time, we had a death in the family, so that necessitated me to drop out of school and go to work to help to maintain the family. But I was fortunate enough to attend night school at the same time work, and I finally, after 6-7 years, I finally got a diploma from the South High Night School. That's the extent of my education.
Mm-hmm. And where were you working at this time?
At the time, I was employed by the General Fireproofing Company. Mm-hmm. And I stayed with that company for 31 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I tell you what, let's... Okay, about what time did you become then... Did you volunteer or were you drafted into our army?
That's what I was going to lead up to.
Okay.
I had a strong desire to go to West Point at the academy. But I realized that I didn't have sufficient education for the entrance examination. So the next best thing for me was to join a local guard unit in 1926. Which was 135th Field Artillery, part of the 37th Division, Ohio Division. And my work and my Army experience almost paralleled each other at just about the time I started to work, too. And I kept both things going. I was very fortunate that my employers were sympathetic enough to give me time off to go to the 10 summer training camp. Otherwise, I couldn't have stayed in the program. Then that kept on going like that for about 15 years until we were ordered to 1 year's active duty by presidential order. And after that 1 year, we were supposedly to return home to the base station and resume your natural activity. But
what year was it that you first joined the Guard?
1926.
1926.
That's right.
Okay, and when was this 1 year active duty by the President ordered? When was the 1 year active duty ordered by the President?
October 15, 1940.
Okay, and, well, go ahead.
Well, just about the time we were supposed to go back for home station, you probably know what happened. War broke out, 1941, Pearl Harbor. Then the draft came into effect. It froze everybody around on duty, and the war became a reality at the time. Now, that particular time, I was too old to go into combat. In other words, we were federalized now. We were part of the Army of the United States. We were no longer National Guard. And since I was too overage in combat, those people that were in a similar category to the South were transferred to the service forces to do various things, such as quartermaster, operate the induction stations, operate the reception centers, the training centers, and what have you, just short of combat. Now, in my particular case, when I was classified, they saw that I had a background of the Italian and French language, and they were sort of holding me off for prisoner of war work whenever we've captured enough people to intern them. And in between that time,
I have various jobs, but
some material jobs. Any branch line, I mean, anybody with plain common sense could perform those duties. And my first job was as a PWO was when they were afraid of the German forces running over England. Therefore, they brought all of these German officers and Italian officers to this country for internment. These people were captured during the Ethiopian campaign, and they brought them to Crossville, Tennessee, in the hills of Tennessee. They set up PW camp, and that was my first duty with prisoners of war. And then most of my work with PWs was interpretation from the Italian language to the English language to comply with the Geneva Convention. Those officers were not required to do any work under Geneva Convention rules. So they spent most of their time holding classes among themselves, familiarizing themselves with the provisions of the Geneva Convention. And anytime they had any trouble, they knew that convention much better than the others did. And anytime they had any trouble, right away they wanted a representative from the State Department or the International Workshop to straighten out their differences. And that was principally my work there.
What rank do you hold at this time?
At present time?
No, at the...
At that time?
Yeah, at that
time. I was a captain.
A captain.
Yeah.
Okay. What rank did you hold in the National Guard?
Well, I went in 1940. I went in as what they call a technical sergeant. They call it a sergeant first class now. And then at the start of the war, I had a reserve commission in the National Guard, and that took effect. I was commission became effective, and I went up through the grades, and when I finally did come out, I came out as a lieutenant colonel. Mm-hmm. And another way, phase of PW work was during World War II, when they captured a great amount of prisoners, they sent them here for work, repatriation. And I had a group of them down in Fort Gordon, Georgia. And the only way they used them down there is on a peanut plantation. They were not required to go to do this work just on a voluntary basis. But most of them comply with the orders because they wanted to get away from camp. Naturally, they don't want to be locked up in turned into camp. It was a welcome relief for them to go out on these farms.
Okay, and at Georgia, were these officers again?
No, they were a mixture, mostly enlisted men.
Uh-huh. Yeah. They kept some officers in with the enlisted men?
No, there were no officers involved there. Mostly enlisted men and non-commissioned officers.
Okay.
And they ran their administration and everything that needed. All we were required to do is just supply them whatever their needs. They operated their own missile, they operated everything, mm-hmm. administered after themselves.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any interesting stories about some of these prisoners?
Well, the most amusing story is this, in connection with their rations. Now, they couldn't get used to the American ration at all. Down at Camp Warden, naturally, they were used to the Italian diet. And they quartermaster, supplied and carried a lot of those items, like oil and flour, stuff like that. So it gave us the normal supply subsistence that the American troops would use. But they came to me, "Hey, Captain, we can't use this stuff." So I said, "Okay, if that's okay, we'll go to the American mess hall and see if we can trade it off for what you can use." So they were stacking butter up to the sky. And that's one item that we took to these different mess halls. And supply sergeants from there, they welcomed that, see? So they traded for oil, flour, and then they took it back to their own mess hall. They made their own spaghetti, macaroni. We had the seating rafters. Like, it looked like a macaroni factory. And they were terrific cooks, too. Most of them, they used as cooks, were cooks during in Italy, in their own country. Some of the best hotels and restaurants. And they used to turn out some terrific meals. But going back a little bit, prior to getting the PW work, they had to use me in one way or another. So I was at a training center at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, being an artillery officer. Fort Bragg was a replacement training center for artillery. It was one of the largest in the United States. And I had a training battery consisting of 400 or 500 people. And we had what they known as a clerk battery. In other words, we used to train them as artillerymen at the same time training them as a clerk, to be clerks in these different places. Then when their 16-week cycle was over, and they'd go to different units that were being activated. And just about that time, they were phasing our training centers out. So I requested to go to school, and I was able to get, just about that time, the Manhattan Project was getting started at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and they required a lot of military police officers. So then I was a branch of material I put in for that, and I was able to get it. They sent me to Fort Ritchie, Maryland. That was the intelligence training center. It was a small camp about 70 miles outside of Washington, D.C. And I went through their CIC course. And I was when I completed that course, I was assigned to a unit in the Philippines. They flew 4 or 5 of us on secret orders to the Philippines, and we had to go through another course, a refresher course, you might as well say, because Matt Clarkford sort of required certain things from the personnel coming from the States. And that was one of the requirements, refresher course under his command. So we got finally assigned to CIC units. But just about that time, the CIC mission was over with. There was really no point in that, because just about that time, the American troops came in on Mindanao and marched all the way down to Manila and finally secured the entire Philippines.
Mm-hmm. What does CIC mean?
Counterintelligence Command.
Command, okay.
Which was part of the military police command.
Okay. And what did they train you to do when you took that course?
To intercept the colored element that were working in the country. In our particular case in the Philippines, there was one communist element known as the Balahops. It was a name given by the government. They were trying to undermine the American army in the, which was coming in there. As long as you're making it, throwing as many obstacles in their road so you can occupy the country. But,
well, okay, and what, if you had got to carry this out, what were you, how were you supposed to identify these people, or what were you supposed to do with them?
Well, actually, try to incarcerate them and question them further to see if they had any ammunition or from the Japanese government. The Japanese government was in that country for 3 years before the Americans came in there. And this one particular group were able to get a lot of ammunition and weapons. And they captured with the idea in mind that when the Japanese army moved out, they were able to stop the Americans from coming in there, or making it as tough as possible for them to operate.
Mm-hmm. I know. When you got over to the Philippines and you had to take that refresher course, what other things did MacArthur want you to know?
Well, there was really nothing new, but the only thing he wanted to make sure that whatever was stopped was in compliance with his teaching. But you see, you can notice he didn't want any dissenters in there.
You can notice he wanted people who supported him to
loyally. That's what he wanted more than anything else, because he was entrusted for trying to rebuild the Filipino army. They were just about down to nothing. In preparation for when the American troops moved out, they could take over and stabilize and control the government entrusted to them. But after that, things looked like a whole lot better than they figured. Then he was transferred over to Japan. And that was it. That was his problem. Ended up the Philippine campaign.
Okay, so you didn't actually get to use any of this? You didn't get to identify any of the communist subversives?
No. Only one person that in our particular sector and that was identified as a leader, as a Colonel Lara. And he was put in under house arrest. He didn't cause any trouble. There was no trouble from the police. Because just about that time, they were all broken up. They weren't organized.
Okay, then what happened to you?
Well, after that, naturally, people were starting to rotate back into the United States. And I had more than enough votes for rotation. But I hung around as much as possible. Finally, I was rotated to the States. And I had 4 months leave time coming. And I was contemplating on going back to work after that 4 month period was over. This was about 1946. And just about that time, the service, the Air Force was being depleted. And it was still a mission to perform. So, just about the time that General Eisenhower was the chief of staff, and he put out a call for anybody who wanted to volunteer to come back into the service. So, I talked a little with the wife. I said, "Well, do you think I should go back?" And I said, "No, I'll take a chance on it." With the idea in mind that your family could go along with you. But as you would have it, they sent me up to a section of the country where housing was in terrible condition. Couldn't bring your family with you. That was up in Alaska, Fairbanks, Alaska. So The Front Bicycle Lounge at that time was known as an Air Force Command. It was known to all Air Force. The only Army troops that were sending up as individual replacement was people on service duty, like military police, clubs, quartermaster, anything like that. Anything with supplies to administer to the Air Force, which was on flying status. And I stayed up there at Ladd Air Force Base for 2 years. And in the meantime, they assisted in building up what they've known right now as Wilson Air Force Base, which they were getting ready to, the Air Command was getting ready to have people, Air Force people to come up there on winter training. Then they'd go back to their station. That was the principal mission of this Air Force Base. In the meantime, they closed up Ladd Field and turned it over to the Army. And after about 2 years, category was left. I said, well, that's it. I came back home and went back to my job. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's go back to the time when you were down in Georgia and Tennessee with the prisoners of war, POWs. Did you ever go out to supervise the prisoners in the some of the farm fields, the plantation working?
Yes. This was in Georgia. There was no word details in the across West Tennessee because those most of those people were general officers. Mm-hmm. They didn't have to go out and work at all. They did request to go out just for exercise. Mm-hmm. And they went out on their own. It wasn't necessary to escort them, just on their honor.
Okay. Where did they go out to?
They went in the city, which was a real small city, uh-huh. Crosswell. Since that time, naturally, it's been built up. But it didn't get too far away. And they were trusted.
Could they speak English?
Some spoke very good English.
Really?
Yeah. That's one thing I can always say, that the American troops were at a disadvantage because they couldn't speak the other languages. Mm-hmm. Or especially the German personnel, all of them spoke English. You didn't have to have an interpreter. Mm-hmm.
This is the officers, the German officers?
Officers and enlisted men.
Uh-huh. Did you ever ask them where they learned English?
No, I never did. Mm-hmm. But I imagine through the normal channels, school channels. Mm-hmm. All right, going back to this, I used to go on my work details with them to see what they were doing, more or less curiosity, that's all. And they were really happy to get out there in the fields. I mean, they got to liken our Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola in the South is a very popular drink. And that's all we got for.
Down the ones who worked in Georgia on the plantation, did they work very hard in your estimation?
Yeah. No, they didn't push them too much. Mm-hmm. They had their own supervisors, not commissioner, supervising them. They didn't work too hard. But remember, they were paid. They were paid 80 cents an hour, but the money was not given to them. It was put in their account, mm-hmm. and then they could buy supplies like, shaving cream, the normal, toilet articles, mm-hmm. from that account.
Did the plantation owner pay them?
Well, they didn't pay them direct. They paid it to the government officials, to the military officials. Mm-hmm. And then their money was put into their account. Mm-hmm.
What did the people who lived in the South, like in Georgia, who would normally be working these plantations, like today, if something like this happened, don't you think the labor union would kind of step in and say, hey, you're replacing our workers? What were the people
called? The war had to be the manpower. Is it what you use most people, or how cops going to pop? Mm-hmm. They were only too happy to get them. Nothing were no trouble. Remember, these were not criminals. They were peepuckers, people like you and I. Mm-hmm. As a result of the war, they were prisoners, that's all. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, they were repatriated into labor groups. Well, where they work without any supervision.
Mm-hmm. Why, there are two types of camps then?
What do you mean?
Well, in the sense that you said there were some camps where you did have supervision and other camps where you didn't, where the men actually did?
No, it's the same type of camp. But, for instance, Italy was the first one that capitulated to the Allied side. So there was no really need of holding these classified as PWs no more. So they made them into labor troops. They could go out on different places without too much supervision, except couldn't go into town or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. How long were some of these prisoners here? How long were some of the prisoners here in the United States?
How long were they? How did I get that?
Okay. How long were they, like, down in Georgia? What was the longest time any POW had been there?
I would say anywhere from 18 months to 2 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this one group that I mentioned before, they had been PW for 10 years prior to the breaking out of hostility.
In other words, they had been captured earlier and then
they were
eventually transferred here.
That's right.
And that was, again, from the Ethiopian campaign?
Right.
Okay. Did any of these guys, to your knowledge, have girlfriends down in Tennessee or Georgia?
Well, there was a few incidents of that, but nothing serious ever came of it.
Did we try to catch them going out of camp, or did we more or less let them go, and then if they came back in the morning and nothing was said?
No, no, we, this during the time that they were going to the fields work, they used to fraternize with American girls, but as soon as the work day was over, they'd come back into the camp. Mm-hmm. They weren't allowed out after that.
Can you kind of describe for me what the POW camp looked like? Did it have barbed wire around it? Did we have guards?
The one I can describe is the one at Fort Gordon, Georgia, you know, just about town. That was a replacement training center too, but it's a larger installation. And it wasn't necessary to build any more buildings. So they used the barracks to house these people. The only thing they did is build a fence around it, that's all.
Did we have guards on duty at night?
Well, just just the minimum, let's put it that way. In other words, we weren't going to use our manpower to the limit to watch trees that didn't need any watchers in the first place.
Mm-hmm. How many?
Most of our PW companies, I'm talking about the American personnel, consisted of one officer, first sergeant, a mess sergeant, and a supply sergeant. That was it. See, the PW did all the work. All we did was supervise them, that's all. Mm-hmm.
Would we leave maybe like say one guard on a night or two guards?
Yeah, right, just the main gate, that's all.
Just the main gate?
Minimum. Yeah.
Can you describe to me, did you ever talk to some of these prisoners?
Oh, yeah. I didn't talk to them. Violent language, that's how they communicate.
Mm-hmm. What were they most concerned with? Did they receive letters from home?
That, yeah, they were concerned about the new people that they knew from our country, trying to contact with these different people. And naturally they could write back and forth, but there was very, very few physical contact made. During my stay, there were about two families that actually came down and met the PWs. Mm-hmm. Of their prior association. Mm-hmm.
Were they relatives or just friends that had known the family? Relatives that had come to this country?
Well, they come to this country.
Offhand, you know, did any of those PWs ever come back to this country after the war?
Yes, I couldn't tell you. I would imagine they did.
Well, you know, had contact with them?
I had no number.
Did they receive letters from home, the PWs?
Oh, yeah. Naturally, their correspondence was censored. Mm-hmm. We'd read the stuff and then turn it over to them.
Did we ever censor anything out of their mail?
No. Their censorship was much easier than our own censorship. We censored our American Jews a lot stricter than we did theirs.
Were they ever given like local newspapers? Could they read about the war? Did they read about it?
In fact, a couple of non-com classmates would give an Italian language newspaper. And my family was given what to call Il Progresso from New York. In New York, so he used to send me bad copies of that, and I turned it over to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they kept up with the war activities.
Mm-hmm. Their letters from home, how did we receive them? Through, you know, through what agency brought the letters out?
Through the American postal system, Army postal system.
The Army postal system?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the only thing is, and the American Red Cross had something to do with that, see, but I don't know what part they played into it.
Did the men receive a lot of letters from home, would you say?
Not too much.
Not too much? Not very many got through?
Not a lot, because they were only restricted to send so many. Naturally, it was an answer to their letters. See.
The money that they made working on these plantations, you said then they kind of kept in local PX to buy things?
Well, it was a... They didn't handle no money at all.
Right.
But I mean... Everything was done on a chip system.
Uh-huh.
Well, once in a while somebody would say, how my account stand? So they would give him a record of his account, how much he had in the... Some fellows were lazier than others. They didn't want to go out and work. Others did, and they made quite a bit of money.
Mm-hmm. Now, after the war is over, all these men were sent home, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. The credit that they had on balance, what happened to the credit?
Well, they probably give it to them. I'm not familiar with that part of it.
Mm-hmm.
They probably gave it to them. It wasn't a large amount, you know.
Mm-hmm. When these men came to the United States, where did they enter? Where did most of the POWs that came here enter the country?
Well, they came through normal port of embarkations like New York, New Orleans. They used that quite a bit on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. They didn't use the West Coast too much.
Okay.
Because we didn't turn too many Japanese.
Uh-huh. Were you ever involved in transporting from one of the ports like New York?
No, that's a different operation.
Do you know who did handle that?
Well, the Transportation Corps.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the Transportation Corps had a replacement training center at Fort Eustis, Virginia. And they trained on all types of transportation. Plane, boat, trains, anything like that. Anything to do with transportation.
Mm-hmm. How large were these camps in Tennessee and Georgia? How many men? How many POWs?
As I said before, it was not a camp set up for that purpose. It was a regular camp. And one section of it was allocated to PWs. All they did is use the same facility, except they put a barbed wire fence on it.
Mm-hmm.
And Fort Gordon, Georgia, was quite a large camp.
Mm-hmm.
It was, during the war, they handled three full divisions.
Oh, really?
Plus a lot of spare parts.
Uh-huh. Okay, now, What, you mean in terms of the prisoners, there are at least three divisions of prisoners, or you mean
the whole camp? I'm talking about the American division.
American division,
yeah.
Okay. How many prisoners would you say, like maybe 200?
Well, our camp was a sub-camp, and we handled 1,500 during the peanut harvest.
Uh-huh. Okay, what do you mean sub-camp?
Well, I think the regular camp, which was set up for that, was located in Louisiana. Naturally, they couldn't use all that manpower. So they requested to come to Georgia to work on the plantations.
Okay, now that's just during the picking season.
That's right.
Okay, then what happened to them after the picking season? Did they send them back?
They sent them back.
Uh-huh. Did you keep any of them around there the whole year?
No.
No, just for that?
Just for that purpose.
Uh-huh. In terms of some of the men that you came in contact with in the PW camps, did any of them seem to be kind of, you know, like wheelers and dealers trying to...
Naturally, yeah, all types of people.
Uh-huh.
In fact, some were pretty bitter about the treatment they were getting. Well, whether they were bitter or not, we were complying with the convention that you treat a prisoner just like you do your own personnel, no more and no less. Mm-hmm. So our hands were clean in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were some that I always asked them how they could stay here without going back.
And what did you tell them?
Well, I had to tell them the truth. I had no knowledge on it. I said, I doubt it very much. You'd probably have to go back to your home country. Then use a normal immigration service to come back into the country if you wanted to get back.
Mm-hmm. Did some of the guys ever escape?
Out in Crossville, Tennessee, some of the German officers were very, very bitter. Some of them, and they told you too. We're going to try to escape every chance we get.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't get the first. Where would they go? They were stuck up in the mountains. After they got out of the camp, the compound, where would they go? They would be found out. It was almost an impossible situation.
Now, okay, you mentioned that in Georgia it seemed that they were a little bit more trustable and we didn't have to watch them, but in Tennessee then, did we have more guards there to watch them?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, can you describe that camp in Tennessee?
Well, it was set up for that particular purpose. That was a mission, to incarcerate and compound these prisoners. There was nothing there to start with. And the camp was built for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
It was a PW camp.
Okay, can you just...
And naturally, the facilities were not quite as good as the camps at Georgia. Because we used the regular facilities to go back in Georgia, see. But up there, we knew the end of the war was just about over. So we didn't need elaborate facilities to house them in, but we did manage to build just enough so they didn't have a gripe against to comply with the Geneva Convention.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can you describe like the fenced-in area? What kind of fencing did we use there?
Well, they usually used a double type of barbed wire fence,
mm-hmm.
With a space about 10 to 12 feet apart.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did it have guard towers?
No, not in Georgia. No, we didn't battle guard towers. We knew that they were safe enough at that particular time in town that we wouldn't have any trouble with them. They just gave them just a bare necessity.
Mm-hmm.
We were impounding them.
Mm-hmm. Did any of these prisoners of war we had here die?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's one group that I'm acquainted with that after they were repatriated, that's what we call it, repatriated and used as workforces. Now, there were quite a few that passed away, and they set up their own new cemeteries. And I imagine some of those cemeteries are still in evidence within the confines of the military reservation.
Mm-hmm. Now, did we have to, those that did die here, did we have to notify?
Oh, sure.
Who did we notify?
Well, I think we did that through the International Red Cross system.
Mm-hmm.
State Department took care of that.
Were any of them ever murdered by their fellow inmates?
No.
No?
Nothing like that.
Mm-hmm. Basically, what they do, come up with like pneumonia or something?
Yeah, just natural causes.
Natural causes.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the end of the war, they were scraping the bottom of the barrel, and they were taking some really old first people.
Mm-hmm. You told me about the Italians in the sense that their rations, the rations that we gave them, they really didn't know how to handle, so they bartered for stuff. How about the Germans? Were they satisfied with the rations?
They seemed to be satisfied with it, because German ration is much similar to American. But the Italian could not cope with the American ration at all. And we were only too happy because some of those American sergeants were only too happy to get butter for flour. They got a good end of that. See?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I went to the quartermaster subsistence officer. I said, "These people cannot use our ration. Can't you make an adjustment?" And he was only too happy because that would bring down his budget.
Okay, we are now on side two of the tape. But you were talking about the bartering.
Yeah, but I was going to say that the quartermaster's assistant officer, he was only too happy to make the adjustment because he was getting a better part of the bargain.
Okay, let's pick up then. After you were up in Alaska now, okay, you decide that you're going to get out at this point, is that right? Okay. You came back to Youngstown?
Well, I didn't come back directly to Youngstown. I said, well, what the heck, as long as we're on the West Coast here, I'll have my wife meet me in Seattle, and we'll take a sort of a second honeymoon throughout the West Coast. So we hit the high points there, like San Francisco, Seattle, and places like that. Then we made our way back home. That was about the most important part of it.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you stay active in the reserve?
Yes, I stayed active in the reserve after I came here. From 1948 until I reached the age limit where they couldn't hold me anymore. And they asked me, what do you want to do, resign your commission or do you want to transfer to an active reserve? I said, well, I'll transfer to an active reserve. And they retired me as a lieutenant colonel, and that was the end of it, actually. I got quite a few citations from the Department of the Army in appreciation for my service and all that.
Okay. Can you list the citations you got? Can you list the citations that you got?
Well, it was more like diplomas, that's all.
Uh-huh.
Like you would receive a diploma in college.
Mm-hmm.
In appreciation for serving your country and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. One was from the chief of staff, one was from the president, and different.
Mm-hmm.
not outstanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay, is there anything that you can think of to add here about your experiences?
Well, that's just about the whole story.
Okay, this brings us then to the end of the tape.